This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Jana Byers, your host, and I am here today with Judith Polman, professor of early modern Dutch history at Leiden University in Leiden in the Netherlands, to talk about her book, Catholic Identity and the Revolt of the Netherlands, 1520 to 1625. This book was first published in 2011 by Oxford University Press, and we are here to talk about it today, and its 10-year anniversary, and on the occasion of its paperback release. Hello, Judith, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks very much for joining me. How are you on this? Is it a blustery day down in Leiden as well?
It certainly is. Autumn has started.
Yeah, today is our proper Dutch weather, yeah?
That's right.
All right. So thanks for agreeing to talk to me today. It was a really enjoyable read. And, you know, in some ways, it's so clear how you came to this. It sits right in your interests, right, of the Dutch, the Reformation, kind of the culture of the Reformation writ large, particularly in the Netherlands. But I'm curious exactly, like, kind of what brought you to this? How did you come to write this book?
Well, there's a long and a short version of this. I suppose my interest in the world of Catholicism and in responses to religious change is triggered by my own family history, because I'm a child born of a family that was very Catholic when I was born, I suppose. But my parents' generation lost their faith, like many other Dutch people, in the 60s and 70s. So I was raised in a secular environment that had, at the same time, very strong memories of a past in which Catholicism had been very important. And when I was listening to my grandmother and so on reflecting on that history and the history of Catholicism in her life, one of the things that she would tell me is that even though they were very committed believers, she felt they were never taken very seriously by their priests. So that lay people like herself, so not just women, but also lay men. So people, you know, in Catholicism, you make a division between lay people, that's ordinary people, and priests who have, who are not just religious professionals, but also have a sacrament that makes them, turns them into priests. And the idea was that the religious professionals really, they were in charge. And my grandmother's generation felt that they weren't taken that seriously by their priests. So so the stories of this, how people respond to religious cultures, and also how this in turn influenced my own parents' decision. My grandparents stayed with the church, but their children all left the church, partly, I'm sure, because they felt ignored by religious leadership, even though the church, the Catholic Church, went through a big change in the 1960s in Vatican II, a big modernization attempt at the church. And it was an attempt to become modern, but it was also very much a clerical affair. And I suppose the frustration that my family felt had something to do with that process of losing their faith. So now I'm an early modern historian. I'm a historian of the early modern period. So that is from 1500 to, in Europe, that means from 1500 to 1700 or 1800. And I've always worked on change and religious change, especially precisely also because these things interested me as a modern person. But for the 16th century, they're also particularly relevant because that is the moment when the great, you know, the big in Latin Christianity, so not the Greek and Russian Orthodox traditions, but the Western Christian traditions, the 16th century is really the moment where everything changes. Because there you have now the Protestant Reformation that splits Europe across new religious lines, and in some countries even splits families across different lines, and it triggers conflict and war. And I was very intrigued in how I've always been very intrigued by how people responded to that change, why some people wanted to become Protestants and others didn't. Why, what they said to their mothers, you know, when you've become a Protestant, what do you go and you go home? What do you say to your mom? Especially since all believers at that time were pretty much fundamentalists. So, you know, you either went, you know, you went to hell, basically, if you didn't. So people had to accommodate that. And I'm quite interested in the sort of human experience of change and how people feel. And how they feel their way through the power relations with priests, with each other, with new developments in their society, that sort of thing.
Right. It's interesting here because I see the two kind of very big historiographical issues that we talk about regarding the era of reformations and Catholic Reformation, which we don't call the Counter-Reformation anymore, but that I, you know, this... This time of turbulence and of European wide as religion is and one's relationship with it is rethought. So, and that's this huge institutional change, right? Like mm-hmm. what the we're going to see at the Council of Trent, and we're going to have these massive institutional changes that's mirrored, I think, in the 60s, right? With Vatican II.
Yes, in some way it is, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's this other story, which is this very personal. How do people practice? How do lay people, how do religious people feel about their interaction with their religion? And you know, you deal with both here. But there's a lot of the personal here. And you know, you start with this story about your grandparents. And I was kind of, so when I was looking through to check out what your sources were, I see how you get at kind of both sides of this Reformation. So, and I think our listeners will find that very interesting. What are you consulting here? What are you using to write this history?
Yes. So, well, the history of Catholicism is traditionally very much written through the archives of the church itself. And that also means you always get that very institutional and professional voice, right? Because the people who built the archives are also the priests and the religious houses and so on. They're the ones in charge. Mm-hmm. So what I wanted to, I had in the earlier part of my career, I'd worked on Protestantism. And I had the idea around in the beginning of the millennium, the new millennium, that perhaps you could use... the strategies that have been used to study Protestantism, and particularly the early stages of Protestantism when it wasn't very well organized, that perhaps you could use the same techniques to think about Catholics too. And that meant that because students of Protestantism worked much more with the voices of individual believers, letters, memoirs, songs, whatever they could find really in traces of how people express their interest, court cases. And we're very fortunate in the Netherlands that Literacy levels are very high there, even in the 16th century, which means that quite a lot of people write, even women write. And this means that quite a lot of people use their literacy to keep records about what they found very important in their own time. So they kept a bit like we all did in the COVID epidemic, you know, when it started, people started to keep lockdown diaries. So I've seen quite a few diaries of people who say, you know, in 1566, when there's a big outbreak of Calvinist violence against images in the Netherlands, and, you know, very angry Catholics sit down and say, the things that are happening now must be remembered. I'm going to write down what those satellites of Satan have been doing here. And so you can see there is a sort of additional, people were literate anyway, and there's a tradition of writing local texts. But they're also, at moments of crisis, people have this, feel this need to try and retake control of their lives in a way to, and start writing down their version of what's just been happening. And I think that's we're very fortunate to have these texts. People had used them sort of anecdotally to tell the story about individual towns. But I was fortunate to a very lovely colleague from the UK, Alistair Duke, at some point gave me a list of texts that he thought. And I thought, of course, it's actually a long list. And it's actually a list with lots of Catholics on it. So perhaps what I could do is to try and write the story of what happened there through these, through the voices of these people. So that's really the idea behind the book, is to try and tell it from people who basically had no idea that what they were witnessing was going to, how that was going to end, whether the split in the church was going to be final, you know, whether it would stay that way, whether there would be new solutions, and who were also deploring the sort of everyday hassle that it brought, you know, confusion in their cities and conflicts in families and war, obviously.
Sure, right. And I think that's an important thing to remember, just, you know, about all the time when we're doing history, but like something like this, it seems so, we have a world where there are Catholics and there are Protestants, and it seems like that would have been, you know, from say Luther on, that's a given, but that's not the case. It's certainly not clear that there's going to be a split in Christendom. That's inconceivable in this period. And then it's not clear for the people who are living through it at all.
That's right. That's right. And even when some people have made a sort of clean break, as it were, of course, that's easier said than done, because they all Protestants are ex-Catholics in this period. Right. So a bit like, you know, the secular generation of my parents, they've had all their friends were ex-Catholics, as it were. Of course, so they're still in some way tied to that past. And in practical sense, 16th century people very much need their families to survive. Mm-hmm. So you can't just ignore the fact that, well, there are still other relationships. Then there are the authorities that have views about this. There's censorship. There are laws against it. Quite a lot of Protestants end up having to flee the country for a long period of time. And then Catholics end up having to flee the Netherlands. So it is a very, very earth-shattering event, even though there are still, throughout the conflict, people who say, so what is this about? Shouldn't we just follow the words of Christ? How difficult can it be? You know, all the sort of things that desperate Irenicists and Ecumenic Christians have been saying ever since. Why is it so hard? You know, how hard can it be?
How hard can this be? Yeah. Well, right. Shouldn't we just follow the words of Christ? That actually is, in fact, the question. Should we? Or shouldn't how about, or are there other things? You know, so I, one of the things that I learned while I was reading this, or really got a grasp on, was just how many people in the Low Countries were very devout Catholics. Like, you know, and I guess I should have thought this through, but I always think of the Netherlands as this highly Calvinist place, you know, particularly compared to Italy, where I work. But there's the majority of the population are Catholic, of the Catholic confession.
Well, the complication here is that in the 16th century, the Netherlands were and Belgium and Luxembourg were one country.
Right.
So at the start of the period, and all of those places were very devout places. If you think of all those wonderful painters in the all those lovely Gothic churches and the wonderful Flemish primitives and so on, this was all commissioned and paid for by people who really cared about their religion. So, and even there's been a phase when people thought, oh well, these people they aren't taking it so seriously. But I think we've changed views on this generally. I suppose that, you know, that was a sort of story that the Catholic Church itself also wanted to tell, because they needed to explain, after all, how the Protestant Reformation had been possible. Mm-hmm. So Catholic history too has this. For a long time has this story, oh, you know, we weren't taking care of this church properly and corruption and so on, and we lost people, and then we cleaned up our act in the Council of Trent, and then everything got back better, and unfortunately we still have some lost souls to regain, as it were. But in our new thinking about this, we've both acknowledged that being a very devout Catholic in the 15th century was a bit different than it would be in, say, the 17th century or today. So, for instance, the best example of this, I think, is about taking communion. So I had in the Catholic tradition of the 17th century, taking frequent communion very frequently is a sign of devotion, and attending Mass all the time is really important, but especially also taking communion. But in the 15th century, they thought that taking communion frequently was a sign of being over eager, really, and it should be enough to witness the miracle of the Mass happening. By witnessing the Mass, you could see the miracle of the transformation of bread and wine into the bloody and body and blood of Christ, and that should be enough for a good believer. So, you know, some historians in the 40s and 50s said, you see, in Flanders nobody ever takes communion. That must be a sign that they weren't very good Christians. But now we think differently. We think, well, you know, people, there were just different standards, and the church, the Catholic Church especially, is not very good at admitting that it's ever changed. So it tends to, you know, it's very much built on the projection of the idea that it's been the same church forever, and that is clearly not the case. I mean, it's developed over time, so that's confused generations of Catholic historians as well. Since the 90s, we've started to think differently about these things, and that also helps us appreciate that Catholics in the Netherlands were really very good Catholics before the Reformation. But of course, that begs the question: so, what went wrong?
So, what happens?
What happened? Why did they then abandon their faith? Why did a sizable group of people abandon their faith? And also, why did the rest of the population do very little to stop Protestantism when it was happening?
You know, those were my next two questions, right in order. So you are doing a great job of interviewing yourself. Please explain these things to me. You are prescient. So yeah, what's next?
So if we think perhaps one of the things that may be helpful in this respect is to think of Protestantism as something that emerges out of Catholicism, something that that is one answer to a number of worries that people have about the state of the church. And it is a radical new answer, because it rejects the idea that priests can help you go to heaven. That contact with the sacraments is necessary to go to heaven. But it emerges, because for Protestants, at least you need fewer sacraments, and priests are in the Protestant way of thinking, priests are not forgiving your sins. God forgives your sins, right? So in the Catholic tradition, in a medieval Catholic tradition, a believer's task is to be a good believer and to take the sacraments and to, and the priests act as mediators between you and God. Now, even in the Middle Ages, people had increasingly, priests had said to lay people, that isn't really enough. You should be doing a bit more than to just turn up on Sunday, take communion at Easter. And to be a good Christian, you really ought to be engaging more with the message of the gospel. They had encouraged reading. They had encouraged meditating on these things. They had encouraged people to look at early Bible translations. There were quite a few Bible translations, even in the 15th century. And so the idea that lay people should themselves make an effort to contribute to this salvation, that it isn't just good enough to, you know, pay for kiss some relics or go on lots of pilgrimages and so on. That is all over late medieval Christianity. Mm-hmm. Now, there are also lots of systemic problems in the church that everybody actually agrees are systemic problems, and that those have to do partly with a lot of that has to do with the fact that the church doesn't really control its own finance or its own personnel. You know, the church is the head, the religious head of the system, as it were. But in fact, it is people on the ground who make the appointments, who have the right to appoint parish priests and so on. And the material, the rewards for those priests are also associated with individual posts and individual churches, rather than in some sort of system where you say a parish priest grade two gets so much money. Mm-hmm. And basically lots of people had, lots of secular rulers got a vested interest in appointing people who they thought needed rewarding. The benefits of those, of good clerical posts were sort of siphoned off by people collecting several of these posts and then putting in poorly paid substitutes to do the job. And all this gave people a feeling that something was not right among its person in among the personnel of the church. And in a way, in some ways, as lay people got better at taking charge of their own piety, and more priests seemed less capable of actually doing the job, for instance, by being a poorly educated substitute, the sense of the sort of self-evident hierarchy between priests and lay people started to shift.
Sure, right. And that barrier kind of breaks down.
And that Luther is the one who draws the most radical consequence of that and says, well, actually, you know, priests are not really that different from other people. They're certainly not better people. Church knew that this could be the case.
Right.
And in fact, we should all, as Christians, prostrate ourselves before the Almighty, and that's including priests. And we can do is listen to God's word, and that should be what gets us into heaven. So the role of priests changes. They should be teachers rather than mediators.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So as we see that there are problems with the church doctrinally and in practice. And so there's the reforming urge that everyone is seeing. And in some ways that happens by the lay people behaving better. In some places, that's by questioning the church. Yeah. So then when some of the population is like, hey, this Luther guy, we should check that out, that's not necessarily discernible from, you know, I should spend more time. I should also be more attentive. I should read my Bible. Is that kind of what's going on here?
No, but I think the sort of people who are used to doing their own Bible reading and thinking that they should be doing more are sensitive to the sorts of messages that Luther is sending.
Okay.
And that's true for both priests and lay people. So some priests think, oh, perhaps I should think differently about my role. Lay people start reading and start talking to each other about these things. And that means that there is especially among the literate classes in the cities, there is a sort of group of people who say, oh, well, we're always talking about how to make the church better. Perhaps this is a way to make the church better.
All right.
So for initially, I think lots of people like Luther himself don't necessarily see that this is going to go into a, you know, headlong break with the church, or they think there must be a compromise or whatever. And they're faced with authorities who are very adamantly against. Their king is very much against all this attitude. But even they are sending us like mixed messages, because they're also really keen on reforming the church and so on. They're also saying, oh, we need, and indeed the Council of Trent is also there to reform the church. So this means that there, I think everybody is quite used in the early 16th century, or by the early, in the mid 16th century, to people who are developing their own ideas on what you might want to do in the church. And you can also see that anybody, as a sort of tradition in the Catholic Church, that if you want to raise awareness, or you want to say we should do things differently, people tend to set up a new religious order or a new religious movement, which then capitalizes and promotes itself by saying, everybody else is doing really badly here, but we are the ones who are going to, you know, do the preaching or doing it better and so on.
Right, yeah.
So that sort of doom and gloom rhetoric, as it were, is all over the place, including among Catholics.
Sure.
The radical new ideas, how radical they are, becomes apparent only gradually. And certainly city authorities and also city dwellers in the Netherlands tend to think that there should be room to have these conversations without that immediately endangering everybody's souls. So they don't like the very their king, Philip, Charles V first, and later Philip II, take a different attitude. They see heresy as a sort of cancer, that if you don't cut off the rotting limbs, you must have that will kill the body. So you must be much more drastic in eradicating heresy. So you can see there's a sort of conflict there. And on the whole, even Catholics, city dwellers, tend to be on the side of moderation and think, oh, well, it should be okay.
These are Dutch people, right? Like proto-Dutch people.
But that's in a way a circle. You know, that's a circular, because that's precisely there are people radicalizing.
Mm-hmm.
Protestants radicalizing, but most of them are forced to leave the country. They're forced into exile, so they're punished. And many of them go to live abroad, as it were, for many years, until they see a moment, finally a window in which they can return. And then they want radical change, and then that change comes in a very violent and drastic way. And Catholics are not very well prepared for that.
Okay. There's this other piece, which is that we have also then the revolt, right?
Yes.
So there is a political change that's happening in the middle of that. How does that map on?
Yeah. Well, I think perhaps we should, the response of the church to all this chaos is to all the new movements could be to get quite combative and lead a fight. And that's what the response of the church eventually was to be. But in the first decades, the church tends to think that the theological fighting should be done between theologians, and therefore lay people shouldn't preach to them about heresy, because that might just give them ideas. People who were otherwise innocent, are you going to talk to them about what really happens in the Eucharist, or are you just going to let them believe that there is a miracle and that's a good thing? Now, they make a sort of judgment call, encouraged by the government, that it's better not to talk to lay people about heresy and to preach about it instead and say, you know, everybody in society has sins, priests have priestly sins, merchants have merchant sins, widows have widow sins, and what we need to do is to let everybody sort out their own sins. Ergo, the problems in the church need to be sorted out by your priest. We will come back to you when we're done. Now, this is very confusing for Catholics because in their everyday lives, they increasingly meet people who say to them, huh, you're still doing that relic stuff. I've read a book that says that that's all rubbish. But there are no Catholic priests who advise you on what to reply to people who say this to you. They say, oh, well, you go away and deal with your widow sins, right? Mm-hmm. So there is a sense in a way in which clerical leadership in this, as Protestantism is slowly spreading under the population, Protestant ideas are spreading, there isn't a very clear answer given by the church, and there certainly isn't any clerical leadership in opposing, in basically mobilizing lay people to do anything about it. So they say, leave it to the professionals, we'll do it. Now, that all goes terribly wrong in 1566 when the nobility of the Netherlands are presenting a petition to the king to say the way you want to solve this problem of Protestantism is no longer the right way to proceed. Because putting up pyres, you know, death sentences, it's really not working. You can see it's not working. And in the meantime, we are now living in a part of Europe where the French are attempting a sort of religious coexistence. The Germans have found solutions to have biconfessional cities. England has become Protestant. Scotland has become Protestant. We have to do business with all these people. We can't kill every Lutheran that sets foot in Antwerp. So come with a better solution. And they think the solution is to get some sort of freedom of conscience, is what they call it. You should be able to let people believe what they want to believe. It's all very unfortunate, all this trouble in the church, but for now you have to just find a way of dealing, integrating it into your society. Now, while this petition is presented in April, and while they're waiting for a response from Madrid, which is a long way away mm-hmm. in this period and takes time, the king's representative in Brussels says, okay, for now, we will just postpone there will be a moratorium on any heresy prosecutions. So we won't be prosecuting anybody. And this creates a window, which I think nobody saw coming, for lots of refugees, people who had fled the country, because to come back and to openly start lobbying for more Protestantism in the country. And they start organizing big rallies around the cities where people come to, you know, people go in their thousands to hear what's going on and so on. And this culminates in a very hot, politically hot summer in which ultimately a group of lay preachers, or Protestant preachers, are starting to promote iconoclasm. And what starts as a sort of incident or two in West Flanders then spreads like a sort of wildfire through all of the Netherlands. And this causes, of course, a major political crisis because now, the call for toleration seems to have produced has let the ghost out of the bottle, as it were, that is, genie out of the bottle. And that is really, so what next? Now, the nobles think the answer to this should be to negotiate with Calvinists, but the king of Madrid has a very different idea and decides to send in a police, a general with an army to put down these rebellious subjects.
Yeah.
Well, there's a very long story, but it basically means this triggers then a conflict that because there is never a moment in which there is a peace is being made, basically doesn't really end the Protestant threat. And the Protestants are back in 1572 when they restart a revolt and ultimately start taking over power in quite a lot of cities and also start to ban Catholicism.
Right, which was not necessarily like a given either that it was going to go that way, that then like this reforming spirit would ban Catholicism. That wasn't, that didn't have to happen.
Well, I suppose the Protestants who had fled, who had had to flee because they were being persecuted, never felt safe when there were Catholic priests around, basically. Sure. So their first impulse was to first of all to Protestantize their own communities, but also to stop anybody else from still preaching Catholicism. That's the absolutist way in which these people argue. And whether that succeeds or not in the Netherlands depends a bit on which part you're talking about, and also how. In the northern Netherlands, what is now the Netherlands, the country, the authorities say, okay, we're going to be all Protestant, but we're not going to spend a lot of energy on persecuting minorities, not least because they had a war to win. So although out there's a sort of semblance of Protestantism, they basically tolerated a bit like Dutch soft drugs policy, as it were. You are not supposed to say that you're selling it, but it's there. What's happening in the southern provinces, so that's current day Flanders, is that there the takeover of Protestants goes together with quite a lot of social activism, which for a variety of reasons means that the regimes there become much more theocratic and much more inclined to actually make the life of Catholics hard. So that in itself creates a problem. I mean, they're everywhere. They're in the course of this armed rebellion against the king and against Catholic authority. There are refugees everywhere, and plots of them, the ex-Protestant refugees, basically chase away some Catholics. But you can see that especially in these Catholic refugee community from the southern Netherlands, they are in various places where they end up having to shelter for abroad. They stop being so... they finally decide that they need to mobilize collectively against the Protestant threat. And you can see that they start doing that under the leadership of new religious groups in the Catholic Church, like the Jesuits. And the Jesuits had initially also felt that lay people shouldn't intervene, but in the course of the revolt, you see that they actually think what we need to do is to train lay people to start doing some of the work for us. Right. So we need to school these people and train them in how to talk to heretics and how to explain to them that what they're believing is wrong and why. And this, you can see that this also finally gives Catholics something to do in this conflict that they're living through. So that, you know, by now we're living in the late 1570s. Mm-hmm. They have now for 15 years been in a position where, from a situation where they thought, well, perhaps we should tolerate Protestants because that's better for business, and why be so difficult to them? They've suddenly become the sort of... underlying party, as it were, in a society that is rapidly where Protestants are taking over control. But they've been struggling to find answers for this, and you can see that in this, under pressure of this radicalism, they are beginning to find solutions of their own. So the, for instance, people in Brussels, which for some time is a Calvinist republic, it's difficult to imagine that now, but it was. People are, the processions are all banned, and all the religious processions that Catholics hold. So people start walking those procession routes collectively anyway, without all the pomp and circumstance. But of course, that's a type of demonstration that the authorities can't do very much about. So there's a sort of passive resistance there. But it's the people in exile, in a way, who develop together with their clergymen a new way of thinking about this that is much more activist, much more aggressive also, and much more counter-reformation, if you want.
But we're, I mean, at this point, we have a new generation as well, right? At this point, there's a group of people who have only known multiple confessions.
Yes. So they also become more, they are themselves clearer on what the difference is, or what they think the difference is, between a Catholic and a Protestant. And this is still not true for many people in the countryside. I mean, even, certainly in the Dutch Republic, we know that deep until this into the 17th century, there are people who still think, what does it matter? Let's follow Christ. But you can see that, especially through the mix with war and violence and power struggle, more people have felt that they need to take sides and that they want to take sides.
Yeah. Okay. How do we get to a tolerant Dutch Republic that is, and how do we have the revolt in the Netherlands? How is that sewn up, and how do we kind of, how do we get to where we are now?
Well, the Dutch, basically this revolt ends up creating two states. One of them is the current day Netherlands, and the other is Belgium and Luxembourg. The Netherlands, the rebels in the Netherlands have not had time to convert everybody by the time they try and form an independent political community. So they're always assuming it's going to take more time they don't have the ministers, they don't have the staff, if you want, to actually make this happen immediately. And they're also having a war to win, and they need people to stay on message for that war, and therefore they decide not to be too pushy when it comes to actually imposing Protestantism. So what they do is they make the Protestants, the Reformed Protestantism, the most favored religion. That is to say, all the church buildings go to them or can be used by them. They will pay for the ministers. They will pay for theological training. They will listen to the advice of Reformed ministers. And only in 1618 do all politicians also have to be favorable to the Reformed religion. All others are officially not allowed to worship, but they do get freedom of conscience. And this is partly a legacy of that, the world of persecution that they had left behind. So the people, the Dutch Revolt was born out of the rejection of persecution and death penalties and so on as the best way to deal with the troubles of Christendom. And this is about the one ideological commitment that they retained, is that they didn't want a system in which people would go and knock on people's doors to see if they hadn't got a statue of the Virgin hidden somewhere. So they, you know, they wanted they said, okay, no more pyres, no more religious trials. We're not going to try anybody for their religious beliefs. That basically meant that they were that what people did at home basically was not the affair of anybody in the state. And so as long as you can do that, it's possible for dissidents to regroup and to at least have religious meetings at home, And increasingly, they were also, you know, harboring priests, paying them and so on. And it's the places where there are enough Catholics to pay for that, because, of course, there is, you know, there's suddenly no money whatsoever, that these communities can survive and can even thrive. The rest of the population has to, you know, people, generally, we think that by 1620, so that's about 50 years after this revolt starts, about only 20% of the population was a card-carrying Reformed Protestant. So about 20% are card-carrying Catholics, 10% Lutherans, Mennonites, that sort of thing. And about half the population isn't, in fact, hasn't made a choice to commit to anything. So they're not secular because they all go to church. They all have their children baptized. They think of themselves as Christians. But they've basically, their conclusion out of all this has been, surely it's up between the Christian and his God have together got to sort this out. So that's quite interesting, because it's about the only place in Europe where this happens, right? Where there is an option not to be anything. So that's very, that's quite new. Now, the Southern Netherlands are different, because there they have, the King of Spain has made his peace with the inhabitants of current day Belgium by saying, okay, so we've reconquered you. That's what the armies had done. We're not going to punish you. So no more pyres here either. But anybody who wants to be a Protestant has to leave. You get 6 months to pay your stuff, you know, to sell your stuff, and you go elsewhere. Anybody who doesn't want to do it, by default, we assume will be a Catholic. So they didn't set up an enormous administration to try and work, you know, to try and force, you know, oaths or anything like that out of people. But basically the message was, if you're still here and you think you can do Protestant things, you are in breach of the law, and you can get into trouble. So people did, some people did stay and did have meetings and so on, but they had to do so in secret. But most people didn't stay, and about 100,000 people, that's a lot of people in a population of that time. That is, you know, they think there were probably about, at the beginning of the revolt, about 2 million people in the Southern Netherlands or in Belgium. So that's a lot of, that's one in five, you know, that's one, that's a lot of people. 100,000 people is a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. And especially if we think about them being like in urban centers, right? These are the people who are moving, right? So
these urban centers really are, you know, they also feel it. And lots of these people ended up going in the, being in the Northern Netherlands and actually being there also the most committed Reformed Protestants in the Northern provinces. Now, what happens in the Southern Netherlands is that something quite funny happens, and that was one of the things that I want to explain in the book, is how it's possible that after this reconquest of the South, the Southern Netherlands then suddenly become the most Orthodox Catholic place on the planet, more or less.
Which is saying a thing in this period.
But it really is, they are really going for it, and I think that is, that's not just that the Protestants have left, because after all, before 1566, Catholics were very critical Catholics. It's also not that the state is suddenly so much more effective, or indeed that the church has so much more control, because the Counter-Reformation church still doesn't control its personnel or its money. And just as in the Middle Ages, I mean, they have better ideas about what they want from them, but it's not as if they can suddenly make that all happen. There's a wonderful book by Craig Harleen called A Bishop's Tale, which is based on the diaries of the Archbishop of Mechelen. And the poor you don't want to be an archbishop in there. You know, it's a very hard life. I mean, the amount of opposition, and almost all of it is clerical and internal. So reforming the church is really hard, but what I think really matters here is that the Catholics who got fed up with Calvinist rule and returning Catholic refugees are actually empowered both by the church and the state to take charge and to redefine what Belgium, what the future Belgium, it's not called Belgium yet at that stage, what those lands have to be. And then you see a sort of raise, you know, these, it's refugee families who build the most, you know, who invest in these fantastic churches in Antwerp and Brussels and so on, by build the commission altarpieces, build chapels, all that exuberance, all those Rubenses, as it were, they're paid for by that generation that has sort of knows what it doesn't want.
Okay. And then at this point, we have two separate areas with two separate religions.
That's
our kind of, that is going to lead us to the modern state of affairs.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. That's right. And because they're at war with each other, they also come to define themselves very much against the others, of course. So there is a sense in which, you know, the fact that there the war between those, the kings of Spain and the Dutch Republic continue up to 1648 also makes it very relevant, as it were, to remind people what they are fighting for and against. And there are you can see that in the southern Netherlands, especially the sort of enormous revival of quite what a generation earlier you would have thought of as old-fashioned types of devotion. So you know, pilgrimages and relic shrines and so on, they become incredibly popular again, partly because also the new rulers of those areas say, well, this is the way to win the war. What we need to do, you know, this war is caused by the fact that we weren't Christian enough and we were failing. And it's only by showing our devotion and our devotion to the Virgin and so on that we can, will ever win this war. So it becomes a very political thing to be a devout Catholic, as it were.
Yeah, right. And it becomes a very religious thing to be a devout, like devoutly separatist government, right?
Yes. So you can say, in a way, in what's now the Netherlands, you can see that because there are so many religious groups, they never managed to create a sort of convincing story, a religious story about themselves. Mm-hmm. So instead, they focus on developing a story about, you know, the Netherlands as a freedom-loving story, that a country that was full of the victims of Spanish tyranny. So that's a secular, a very almost nationalist story, like we know of the 19th century, many countries in the 19th century. Whereas in the southern Netherlands, where they have a much easier time, they just fall back on a sort of this, you know, our love for this dynasty has forever, been there, and together we've always been committed to the Virgin.
Right. Indeed. All right. Yes. Always committed to the Virgin is a very important part of the
So it is, and you can see that culture, that way in which that is developed and culturally and so on, I think inspires, for instance, also the piety of the Austrian Habsburgs when they, in the 30 Years' War, start to re-Catholicize the empire. They take a leaf out of the book of their cousins in Brussels on how to actually make that happen.
That is fascinating. Ah, wonderful. Thank you so much. Judith, I've taken up quite a bit of your time, and I know you've got even more to do this afternoon. So thank you for spending some time with me. Congratulations on the paperback copy of this book.
Thank you very much.
And it's been a while since you wrote it, so thanks for taking some time to talk to me about it. But it's an important book, and I want it to be available to our listeners.
So thank you.
Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
All right. You have a lovely day.
Thank you.